Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Welcome to a special bonus episode of the Late Night with Seth Meyers podcast. Recently, journalist Edward Isaac Dover visited our 30 Rock offices to chat with Seth for Politico's Off Message podcast. If you enjoy their conversation, subscribe to Off Message for weekly interviews with political leaders, journalists, and other newsworthy figures. Without further ado, here's Seth Meyers and Edward Isaac Dover.
In the 7 years since you hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner, you got a late night show and Donald Trump moved into the White House.
Yeah, a lot happened.
Are you surprised how much you're still in his head?
I was delighted to see that he was still thinking about it. I'm not that surprised because it strikes me as moving on from grudges is not a thing that he does right. with any regularity. So I don't think I'm alone in being somebody that's still sticking in his craw.
But why were you delighted? Because you're still sticking in his craw?
Yeah. I mean, I just still think – when I look back at that night, the reason I don't have any regrets about it, even with the outcome, is he so deserved it. And for those who forget, you know, that was in the heart of the birtherism stuff. That was the, you know, the heart of the birth certificate. And I just thought he deserved it. And I still think he deserved it. So, you know, for me, the fact that there was a night where he got to be the butt of those jokes that he had asked for, I was happy to be a part of it.
And you called it one of the greatest nights of your life.
It was, I mean, that, you know, independent of even that part of it, you know, if you take the Donald Trump out of it, it is for the same reason that I'm sure Michelle Wolf feels like it was one of the great nights of her life. You go into it, it's built for you to fail because it's such a terrible room for comedy. The audience is, you know, more split on politics than probably most comedy rooms. And
sort of worried about laughing at things.
That's yeah.
Sort of sound. And I would see that in the Obama years when he would go and he would tell the jokes, I would see Republican members of Congress who were like fighting, laughing.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting, I was at a table with this woman, Kathy McMorris Rogers, who's in the House leadership, Republican. And she was laughing at a joke and like trying to stop from laughing at one of the Obama jokes. And yeah. So that's hard. And then you don't want to get caught on camera. You don't know where the camera is, right? Like from being in the audience of the dinner.
Yeah.
Right? So like, that's what you're facing then looking out of the audience.
But also you're looking out of the audience. It's such a wide room. A lot of people are watching you projected on screen. So if you actually play the room, very less people than you want are looking at you. Plus, you know, when I did it, Obama was just to my right, and I feel like ultimately it's probably more interesting to watch Obama watch me than it is to watch me. You know, I think to some degree Michelle had that with Sarah Huckabee Sanders. But the reason it was the best night of my life, one of them, you know, my parents were there. Mm-hmm. My parents couldn't believe I got to tell jokes next to the president. A lot of my friends from SNL were there. We went to a party in a French embassy afterwards. It was, you know, very few nights where you go out and perform comedy and in such nice fashion.
Trump called it a weak performance.
Yeah. Though. I mean, well, that I think that makes me feel good as well, because now everything that he says, when he says like there's a weak case for collusion, I feel as though, oh, he doesn't understand what weak means, because I just think it means he doesn't like it. But he wishes it would go away, because I'm not somebody who I'm judgmental in my performances. There are things I've done that I think, oh, that was that was flat. And that was, I don't walk around thinking everything I did was great. But I look back on that night and I'm like, oh, anybody who thinks that's weak has a misunderstanding of
what. It was a pretty well-reviewed night at the time that was immediately overshadowed by what was happening at the same time, which was the Bin Laden raid. So nobody really remembers your routine joke by joke, except then because of the Trump stuff, then it came back. Right.
People go back and they revisit the Trump part. But, you know, and again, I should stress, and I think this is true of everybody host that night, you get all your friends to help.
Right.
So it wasn't as though I went out and wrote 20 minutes of stand-up comedy about the year in D.C. I had a lot of help. And I feel as though those jokes that we all wrote together hold up really well.
The one that you said, the one that everybody pays the most attention is say you're going to run as a Republican. I thought you'd run as a joke.
Yeah.
Right?
Was that one yours?
Or?
That was not mine. I don't quite remember who wrote it. Alex Bays, who's our head writer now, is probably the best bet for most of those jokes. He, for my money and a lot of others, is the best joke writer in the country. So it's a good chance that he wrote it. No, I should stress, by the way, you know, I'm like, I look back on the night, I don't have any regrets. But Donald Trump, threw it in my face.
Right.
You know, and when you go back to that, you're running as a joke. I held that position that he was running on the joke right
up to the moment
when he won.
Yeah, you talked about this, right? Yeah, that you have looked back on it and rethought all of it, right?
I not rethought as, oh, gosh, if only I hadn't done that. I've just gone back and said, like, boy, as far as, like, you know, I'm willing to admit that in the long run, I lost. So I just want to make sure that's clear.
That, line that he said in a Time magazine interview last year, like, I'm president and you're not.
Yeah.
Right? So,
of course. Right. Yeah. I mean, I feel like there was a time leading up to the election when there were a lot of articles being written about that night and whether or not I convinced him to run. And some of them would mention myself and Obama, and some would mention just Obama and would leave me out of it. And I, because I was so sure he was going to lose, I really always wanted credit for also having tricked him into running. I feel like as though we set up a perfect plan and then the voters blew it.
How's it different making fun of him versus other politicians?
Well, it's tricky because, you know, I've only been doing this job for, it feels like he's covered so much of this, my time doing this show. So as far as
a little bit of Obama overlap,
a little bit of Obama, but it was sort of end of Obama and it was also leaning into the election. So there was so much of that. And that seemed to be, you know, as far as comedy went, it was like 18 months leading up to the election. So it was mostly this. I can say that in my time at SNL, which was different, you weren't talking about it every night. Obama was tricky because, you know, he was pretty self-aware and also conventional. You know, one of the problems I think people like me and people who do shows like mine are dealing with is you have so much unconventional stuff coming in every day. It's a lot of noise and just trying to distill down what of the most unconventional things you want to focus on. Whereas with Obama and, you know, whatever you think of how she would have been a president, I think you would have to say, oh, Hillary Clinton would have been more conventional than this too. You would have to look for stuff a little bit more. We were looking forward to, obviously, we thought that was going to be the outcome.
Right.
And we were looking forward to solving that problem of how you talk about a conventional president.
Do you think it's because you liked Obama more in your own personal politics? I mean, you liked him, right?
Well,
you don't
Trump. I think you step back and you say, well, even people who didn't like him, you know, when they had to find scandals about Obama, it was he wore a tan suit.
Right.
So not to equate, but I would say the closest thing to liberal comedians are Fox News commentators, right? As far as we're going to go into the minutiae and we're going to pull out stuff that we think is ridiculous about these people. So did I like him more? Absolutely. But at the same time, you know, there just wasn't that much that was inherently funny. I mean, because again, you know, going back to the correspondence dinner, the hardest thing about the year I did it and the 8 years for the eight comedians who had to do it when Obama was president is you had to follow him, and he has and continues to have a stand-ups rhythm, you know, and great jokes as well. He has great taste for comedy. So,
and all the people who wrote jokes for him would always say that. And he did. He just had a good sense of how to do it.
And it was like that thing where, you know, sometimes you'd get somebody on SNL as a host who was so famous that it was just funny to watch somebody that famous do something silly. Obama was more famous than all of them combined, and he had great delivery, and he had great jokes. So that was the trick with Obama. I know there's, you know, I don't want to defend everything he ever did. And I know there are people who didn't like him, but I don't think there's anybody who could say he was a buffoon.
No, I don't think that his, even the people who really don't like him would say that. But what about Trump? Is he inherently funny?
Not only do I think there are inherently funny things about him, I think that there are times where Donald Trump is funny in a way that if he was an older relative of yours or a high school friend that maybe you outgrew, but when you saw, you remembered how much he used to make you laugh in the back of math class. I think he says a lot of things that he doesn't have any sense of what's coming out of his mouth, but there are times where he says things where that's funny. I remember there
like
was
intentionally funny.
There was a prayer breakfast. I remember where he started by asking all the leaders, all the prayer leaders there, to pray for Arnold Schwarzenegger's ratings. Yep. And I just thought that, you know, that's kind of funny.
That's a good joke.
Yeah. Right? And it's a funny thing to do in this room on a day where it's not about.
Because
stuff
the way that
like
a lot of people interpret that is like how you go to the national prayer breakfast and you talk about Arnold Schwarzenegger. And it's just so terrible to do that. But you think it's
he
like.
Would just, I do think he's kind of one of those guys. And again, in life, they're not bad people to be friends with, the ones that, you know, don't put a lot of thought into the decorum of the moment. Mm-hmm. I will point out that is one of the great hypocrisies about Trump supporters taking issue with Michelle Wolf and the idea that she somehow did not play into the decorum of the evening when they're supporting someone who has no sense of or no respect or not someone who observes the idea of decorum. And I think that they're drawn to it from him and then the idea that other people should have to live by those.
Well, look, you see that going on with a lot of things, right? He gets criticized for transparency and security stuff that he was attacking Hillary Clinton for when it came to the email server. And like, there's some similarities to what was going on there. And it's not just with Trump supporters and Trump. You see that
I don't think it's a
moving standard of
I think that's true. I don't want
right?
to. I want to make.
But I do. Like, I think you're right that like there is something weird about Trump supporters saying, I can't believe that comedian was so vulgar.
Again, I knew her, so I could believe every part of it.
Right. She worked for you.
Yeah.
But in this forum, it's just.
Yeah. You know, it's fascinating now, and I pay more attention to it now after I did it than I ever did before. But it's so cyclical that it seems like every year or every other year. You realize how many people in Washington think it's a foolish evening to begin with, independent of how the comedian does or doesn't do. Just the very fact that it's an elbow rubbing between the people that you're supposed to cover and the people who are covering those people. But, you know, there's very few things. I guess I would say the closest there were times when I was at SNL long enough that people would write think pieces like, when's it time to cancel SNL? Like, I feel like that's.
That was every 2 years. Also,
every two or three years, somebody would say, haven't we had enough of this? And I feel like the White House correspondent.
I don't remember who said it. The best years were the years that you were in high school because that's when you.
Well, who else has time at 11:30 on Saturday to engage with this stuff?
And it'll never be like that again.
Of course, that's the way I feel.
Well, I'm sure it's not just your high school years when you were actually on it. You probably like those years, right?
I would say those years hold up as strongly as any, but probably more so with the people that were in high school when they were happening.
So Trump is funny, but do you feel like, I mean, there's the sort of laughing at him and laughing with him. You do a lot of laughing
at him.
Oh,
we try not to laugh with him much, yeah. I'm conceding the point, but we don't make a lot of room on our show for the moments where we thought he was hilarious.
You've turned him into an object of ridicule, right? He's the president.
Mm-hmm.
Does that give you pause ever?
No. First of all, I would argue he turned himself into an object of ridicule. Again, this is a case of judo where you're using someone else's momentum against them. Mm-hmm. It's not like we're attacking. We're just sort of like very steering his weight and letting him take himself down. But there was a sense, I spoke the night of our first show after the election and was very honest about the fact that I didn't think this was going to happen. I tried to empathize with the people that voted for him and realizing that they might have done it out of a place of fear. I tried to have best intentions. Now, the speed in which he proved that he was going to be what we thought he was going to be was almost immediate. And you know, it's a small thing, but, you know, screaming about inauguration skies is not like that's not something that wasn't indicative of a bigger problem that was going to come and has come. So look, here's the good news for him. Once you're the president, there are legal barriers mm-hmm. that you can use. And I do believe he's going to end up using most of them. But there aren't, you know, this idea that, like, you can't make fun of a president. No one's ever lived by it. And this is a president who deserves it the least.
And not that he didn't deserve it for Richard Nixon. But the Richard Nixon thing that people talk about is that he sort of demystified the presidency. People talked about the presidency in a very different way afterwards. Do you think that that's going to happen here? Whatever the party affiliation is, you just go look at what your show's doing, what every late night host is doing, comedians. And it's like, you can just really mercilessly mock the president of the United States, call him a clown, say he's terrible. And
yeah, but you know, you have to, again, it doesn't resonate when you call not a clown a clown.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we'll see who the next president is. I think there's a real reminder that, you know, when you say a president has to be a citizen, the president has to be 35 years old, like all those things. The thing that we're reminded here is like, oh, the main thing a president is a human being. Mm-hmm. And like that, if you can be a human being, like ultimately you can get in the door and then be human.
Yeah.
Whatever kind of human you are, you can just do it all day long and then you're the president. So that is has been eye-opening how that is just allowed to happen. But in general, you know, I would love to watch people try to behave or treat the next president exactly the same, because I just don't even think, even if it's a Republican, it's not going to be the same kind of person ever again.
Because there's only Donald Trump. Right?
There really is only Donald Trump.
I mean, I had a conversation with an editor in our newsroom the day before the election, the Monday afternoon before the election, when we were thinking, okay, if Hillary wins, these are our stories. If Trump wins, these are our stories. And a story that I had said I was going to write if Trump had lost is that there is no next Donald Trump. There's only like, he is a singular figure in America before he's president, right? Like,
yeah,
right. And that's part of why he was elected president. If he had lost, and it wasn't like, okay, well, so who's the businessman who will do this in 2020 or whatever? Like, who's the reality TV star who will do this?
Well, the other interesting thing is Donald Trump has so much charisma. Like, he's just inherently charismatic. Mm-hmm. You are drawn to watching him. He's magnetic. You know, there are politicians I agree with who come on the show, and the minute they start talking, you know where it's going, and you can just zone out through the process of that. There is something about not knowing where he's going to end up or how he's going to get there or the circular logic or the sentence structure that does make you kind of tune into it, because he kind of busted all the algorithms for how politicians speak. The interesting thing has been to watch how people who run on a Trump platform post Trump getting elected, it doesn't look as good on anyone else.
Yeah, they're all struggling with it.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of his rhetoric comes out as more charming because of his charisma, and then you try it on someone else and it comes out hateful. And so that has been the interesting thing. And I'm thankful. I'm like, oh, this isn't – like, there's no Trump playbook for anybody but Trump.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like – I feel like it's like, okay, I watched LeBron. I watched like 3 LeBron games, so I think I'm good to go. You just like dunk, right. You double team, you do the spin thing, jump real high. And ultimately, like, these people don't have any of his physical
gifts.
Where's
your multi-million dollar contract?
Exactly.
Right? How do you think journalists have been doing covering him?
Well, I think it's an incredibly high level of difficulty. We can't do our show without the work that journalists do. And so I feel as though they've been doing a pretty good job. I also feel like journalist is a weird umbrella term that covers too many different ways that people do it as a profession. To call people who write for newspapers the same as people who are on cable news, who are people on network news, like it seems like a weird blanket to throw over everyone.
And it's sort of come up as Sean Hannity sometimes calls himself a journalist and says, I'm obviously not a journalist. And like, there is this, well, okay, he does an hour show that is news based every night.
Yeah.
On a channel called Fox News. Is he a journalist? Is he a TV host? We don't need to get into Hannity, but I think you're right. Like, and it's just the media or whatever. I don't know. There are a lot of people who could be counted in the media now who you wouldn't have even counted in the media 10, 15 years ago.
And the other thing is it's all a business. And, you know, I know there's a lot of, you know, going back and looking Monday morning quarterbacking how the lead up to the election could have been handled differently. And I'm sure, look, everybody makes mistakes. I mean, you could go back and do things differently. Everyone would. And with that said, like this idea of like we pay too much attention to Trump, I got to be honest, I don't know what else to pay attention to. You know, he is now the president. So I think there's more fair criticism in the lead up to it. But as of now, you know, we certainly think he's newsworthy every day. But with that said, you know, we're only, you know, we only have basically, you know, somewhere between 10 to 15 minutes a night. Right. That's going to be about the day's events. You know, when you have a cable channel that's 24 hours, like maybe you could split it up a little bit better. But I'm not smart enough to know how to do a better job. And again, because we're such a beneficiary of good journalism, like we feel like it's a good job has been done.
What do you think it's done to your audience that you have been identified? You have identified yourself. The show has become identified as like, it is very clearly not a Trump-friendly no. show, right?
Yeah. Well, again, I think that, you know, a lot of people talk about how no one knew what Carson thought. Like mm-hmm. Johnny Carson's always held up as, you know, this mystery as far as his own personal politics. That is so many generations ago. Yeah. And these things change, you know.
It's, and he went up there in 92, right?
Yeah. Like, but when you really, I mean, I think that the biggest shift was, because SNL, I think, always to some degree wore their politics on their sleeve. I think that more importantly, Stewart and Colbert were all of a sudden these shows that had a point of view. And I think that there is this authenticity that an audience is very hip to now that maybe they weren't before. Right. Now, again, when you add up all of these late night shows, you know, if you add up all the ratings, it's not everyone in the country. Right. You know, a lot of people are coming and watching other entertainment options. Yep. And I celebrate their choice to do that. And I'm sure, you know, when the election first started, there were people on Twitter who would say to me, you know, I used to love your show and now I can't watch it anymore. Right. And like, I wasn't upset or angry at those people. And I didn't think they owed me anything to stick around and watch me, you know, run down somebody that they believed in. So
do you think there are more people who came to the show because and stuck with the show?
I think so.
I was having this conversation with a Democratic operative who said, see stories now of like some organization does something that seems like not Trump friendly. And like four people say, like, I'll never shop there again. Right. And the person said to me, well, how many – what you don't see is ever stories that look at, are there 20 people who do decide to shop there or who do decide to tune in and who maybe stay around, who feel like identified with you because you're saying what they are feeling.
Again, I should point out that had we bled out as far as viewers, we would have been told. You know, this wouldn't have been something that NBC knows and hadn't
been like,
mentioned.
Okay, Seth, enough with the Trump stuff. Right.
They legally have every right to tell us if we're bleeding out on ratings.
And the point this person was making to me again is that like there's a brand loyalty that happens now.
Yeah.
People are not attached necessarily to parties or causes, but there's like people are positively attached to things that they like. And for a long time, it seems like. You think that you're getting those people?
I certainly hope so. You know, I think it's all, you know, another thing that is helpful is, you know, if you are providing a product that's convenient for people to consume, you know, whenever there people are upset that, oh my God, this happened on United or this happened on Delta, like I find it hard to believe that the cheaper fare isn't the next one they're going to book. But we do try and we really, you know, for us, we had this, you know, 18 months into doing our show, this awakening of, oh, we want to be this kind of show. We want to spend the first act of our show being our newspaper act where we're talking about the day's news. And then that became this promise we made to the audience that we now enjoy keeping. And it's really nice that not just when people watch it online, I'm sorry, not watch the show, but then, you know, the next day when they watch Closer Look online, it's nice. Yeah. You realize, oh, this is what it looks like when you build
you
a brand.
You can track all those numbers and you see what it is again. Right? I mean, Trump might say, well, yeah, but my Apprentice ratings were better than anything that they're getting on late night.
Yeah, he could say that. He'd be right. Well, I mean, look, Roseanne could say it and she'd be right as well. With that
doesn't
said,
bother
though,
you.
Well, look, I don't, you know, not only could I not host The Apprentice, I wouldn't want to, but I think you do the shows you want to do. There's no way to show up here every day and have the energy and enthusiasm to go out and perform for an audience every night if it wasn't what you wanted to do.
What do you think would happen if somebody showed up, applied for a job, and they say, like, I'm a Trump voter?
It will be interesting.
I mean, think that they would – maybe they wouldn't even get – it would be self-selecting at this point or
– well,
what would
I mean,
you make of them if they ended up in this seat?
Well, if somebody got a job here as a comedy writer and we liked their pack and we hired them as a comedian and then they said, I'm a Trump supporter – I would be thrilled to have a Trump supporter who had a comic voice that fit the show, if that made sense. Like, the voice has to fit first.
Sure.
And, you know, different perspectives. I mean, that would be a really cool thing to have around. And just to have conversations. Because here's the thing.
Do you encounter those people?
Not as much as...
I mean, you live in Manhattan.
I live in Manhattan.
You work at Rockefeller Center.
I do. I've done a few charity events recently in other parts of the country, and there is something nice about when it's a good cause. I've had people come up to me and say that they voted for Donald Trump. And
they still decided to buy a ticket.
Yeah, I better not make fun of him.
And do you?
Yeah, but not, but less so. I should stress, like when a night is for a good cause, mm-hmm. my take is always that this is a night to put that aside. Mm-hmm. If we're all here, like we all agree that to raise money for a good organization, like I'm not trying to make people feel bad about themselves.
Right.
But yeah, you know, the thing I would say is like a barrier to entry at our show, and this is like if someone acts like an asshole mm-hmm. in the process to getting the job. So if somebody came through here and had the talent and was a nice person, and you know we talked to other people they'd worked with, mm-hmm. and they were a nice person, and then they got here, and then they you know their political leanings came out, I would be thrilled to say, oh my god, we have a talented, nice person who can help inform me about how the other side thinks.
Do you think that person exists?
I would like to believe that person exists.
One of the reasons I ask it is because there's in this, like, what do we do about the White House Correspondents' Dinner? One of the ideas that is being floated apparently is that there would be like dueling comedians, the left-leaning comedian and the right-leaning comedian.
Yeah.
It seems like a weird idea.
It's a weird idea that I would just be fascinated. You know,
it is like the parody of like, we have to hear from both sides,
yeah.
right? Like, even at the Correspondents' Dinner with comedians, we have to hear from both sides. But then the thought that I have about it after is, like, there are not that many comedians that I can think of in this moment that I would identify as a pro-Trump comedian. When you take out someone like Roseanne, who's not doing stand-up anymore, but,
right.
then who are we even talking about? It's not a lot of people, right?
Right.
At least high-profile people.
I think there are conservative comedians. I don't know how many of them are Trump supporters. Because, again, I do think there's this large swath of conservative voters, conservative thinkers who haven't been able to come to terms with Trump.
If we're going to hire a comedian, right? Like, you're not going to hire, like, it's not going to be like you and Bill Kristol or whatever. Like,
right.
Kristol is not like the example of a pro Trump person.
I mean, I will say that something that is getting lost in Michelle Wolf's is she called Ted Kennedy a murderer.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that was, I actually think that if everybody actually settled down and looked at her jokes, there were quite a few about Democrats that, it's not to say that she's a Trump supporter, but she thinks you're all ridiculous.
Right.
She thought everybody in that room was ridiculous.
Not
and
wrong.
That seems like what the point of it is.
And I mean, the problem with the way that this whole thing is that within minutes, like the outrage had already been like, she made fun of the way Sarah Sanders looks. And she didn't.
Right.
Like, she made fun of her makeup. And you could take issue with that. You could take issue with her calling Sarah Sanders a liar. But like there was not the only other joke that was about her is that she looks like Aunt Lydia in The Handmaid's Tale, which I don't think is like it was sort of a looks thing, but was sort of about that role.
I can see people parsing it either way. I think at the end of the day, though.
My point is like the outrage was already gone,
yeah.
right?
Like, it was a weird thing to watch how quickly it happened.
Were you watching it live?
I wasn't watching it live. I was at a wedding. Yeah. So I watched it that night. It was pretty exciting to already kind of hear the
you
outrage
knew,
simmering.
Right? Yeah, I was not there in person, but I didn't watch it live, but I saw some tweets and stuff beforehand. And then so that like framed my going into it. And then I watched and I was like, oh, okay, like I see where people tagged onto it. But like that's what happens, right?
It's, you know, I get that there's so many parts of the night for people who write and live in D.C. and care about politics and write about politics that they feel that the core of the night is busted and that it's just not what it sets out to do. It would be a shame to lose the spectacle mm-hmm. of a comedian every year having to approach that evening because so many fascinating decisions come out of each different comedian's approach.
Yeah.
And I do feel like my friends who are not from the States couldn't believe that I told jokes to Obama.
Right, there's that. Right.
On the dais. Now, I know we've lost that element of it without Trump here, but it's, you know, and it's not the only great American thing that also has a downside. you know what I mean? Like, I guess it's a little bit like NFL football. Like, when it's best, like
some
it's
people
amazing
are going
to
suffer
work.
Concussions.
Yeah, but some people, like 30 years after each one, you're like, oh, that didn't turn out well for them.
I mean, it's an inherently ridiculous event. It's a comedian standing up. It's not a serious thing, right? Like,
right.
Because somebody's supposed to stand up there for 20 to 25 minutes and tell jokes and make fun of everyone.
Right? Yes.
And the president is supposed to also. Do you think David Litt, who is one of Obama's speechwriters and was involved in some of the Obama remarks mm-hmm. the same night that you hosted and others, has talked about how it's caught him that Trump doesn't really ever laugh. And he says it's like a window into him
yeah.
and his approach to the world and the regard that he has for other people and for himself. Do you think there's anything to that?
It's interesting. I can say that when he hosted SNL in 2004, which is a time before anybody obviously thought of him as having any political aspirations, he did not strike me as somebody who had any ever even processed if something was funny or not. It was just...
What does that mean? How do you go through it? He would have been in his mid-60s by then.
Yeah. He liked things where if the joke was about him being handsome or rich, mid-50s. He liked it. You know, if the premise was based on his looks or his success, he would say, oh, I like that. But he wouldn't laugh or smile. And...
Not one time. And
I have no memory of it. We did this sketch, which was a sketch I really loved called Donald Trump's House of Wings, which was he was a guy who owned a chicken wing place.
Cock-a-doodle-doo, folks. I'm Donald Trump. And there's two things in the world I love, a good deal and a good meal. So when I drove by a defunct Meineke muffler shop in Englewood, New Jersey, I knew what I had to do. I had to buy it on the cheap and convert it into a restaurant specializing in buffalo chicken wings. So I did. And it's the most important thing I've ever done in my entire life. So please, join me at Donald Trump's House of Wings.
Trump, you know our wings will make you happy. Trumpy, you know our wings will fill you up.
But he was Donald Trump who owned
he
a chicken
wing? He was Donald Trump who owned a chicken wing place, maybe in Secaucus. I can't remember. But
it
was
like where it would happen.
To Jump, the Pointer Sisters song Jump uh-huh. was the song. And me and Kenan Thompson and Amy Poehler and Maya Rudolph would come out dressed like chickens and eggs and sing the theme song while he talked about this investment he made. And he always thought it was so stupid. And every time we rehearsed it, he would talk about how dumb it was and how it wasn't going to work. And then when we did it, and even if you watch it at air, the audience like loses their mind. They love it. And he has this moment where the minute they like it, he likes it.
Mm-hmm.
He just processes. He could immediately process that it was working.
Mm-hmm.
And then as it went on, he kept getting better and better. He would dance more. He
Through
the sketch.
Which like, must have been 3 minutes long or whatever.
Yes,
right?
But he like caught the wave of like, this is working. What I have seen at rallies when he was running for president and things were all of a sudden like bits that worked, like when build the wall or lock her up became mm-hmm. catchphrases, I realized, oh, that's the same brain that eventually was convinced that Donald Trump's House of Wings was a winner mm-hmm. is the one that's realizing lock her up is a winner, which is all. And the only thing is that the audience likes it.
Yeah.
And that
he knows how to read a room.
He knows how to chase it. He knows how to harness it. And he'll just keep riding it. You know, I only regret if Donald Trump's House of Rings had been a longer sketch, he'd still be doing it.
It could have been a recurring.
Could have been it, yeah.
I mean, I remember a couple, like a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months ago, he said that Democrats were committing treason, but it started out because someone in the crowd shouted it out. And he was like, yeah, treason? Maybe it is treason.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Like, yeah, I'll call it treason. It was sort of that, right? And like, I guess that's the same thing you're talking about. Right?
Yeah. Which is, by the way.
And then everyone was like, treason! But the way that it got covered, and I was like, how could he just in such a nonchalant way say treason for Democrats? Which, hey, treason for Democrats, it's a jump. We'll put it that
yes.
way.
yeah.
But it didn't seem like there was this like thought process where he was like, oh, no, what I want to do is hang Democrats.
Right. I do feel... It again, stand-ups who work their act, who are just like always looking for new things. Like they have a premise and then it's about like building it out and finding their laughs. And that I do feel like he was like a road comic who just was like building this act over the course of 18 months that ultimately became, you know, a huge HBO comedy special.
So where does that leave things now?
In the White House. Things are in the White House. I don't know. Yeah, you know, ultimately, like, I would like everything to resolve itself at the ballot box. Mm-hmm. So
you're not an impeachment fan for all of your dislike of Trump.
Yeah, I'm not an impeachment fan. You know, there might be things that we find out that mm-hmm. that doesn't strike me as an outcome that would be good or peaceful to go through. Whereas, and by the way, I don't know what it's going to be like if the ballot box decides to go another way either. But I'm certainly paying close attention to that. Like that, you know, if at your core you believe democracy is the answer to problems, I'm looking forward to the next time.
And you're like pushing people. Do you feel like part of your job is, we had Chris Matthews on last week, yeah. and he said he feels like TV hosts, cable hosts are teachers in a way, right? Like they have to yeah. inform people, and they come from opinionated places too, he said, and he does. Do you see part of your job as helping people get to that, the sort of clarity about what Trump is?
About what Trump is, yeah. I don't feel comfortable like endorsing one candidate over the other, but I do feel like, and again, we try very hard to be like the simplest way to describe our day is like, this is what happened yesterday. Mm-hmm. Here it is with a bunch of jokes.
Right.
But like, this is just very simply put things that happen, which we think are important. And, you know, to go back to do Trump voters watch the show or not watch the show? I, for one, don't think they watch the show. But even if they did, you know, people have said, do you really think you're convincing anybody or changing anybody's mind? Mm-hmm. I will say, like, I don't think that there's a certain amount of supporters of any candidate whose minds are never going to be changed. The difference in most elections are the people who didn't vote last time who are going to go to the polls this time. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, if I just could encourage people to vote. And I think the way you do that is just get people engaged in what's happening in the world.
I asked you about what would happen if a Trump supporting writer wanted to get a job here. Let's close with this. If you get a call here in late 2019, 2020, says President Trump wants to come on the show. He's running for re-election. He wants to come on. What do you do?
Well, it's a classic hypothetical, and that is never going to happen. I will say that we were talking in before he was it was 2014 because I had run into him at the SNL 40th. Mm-hmm. And we were talking to him then about coming on the show. I didn't think he was really going to run. Mm-hmm. I thought it'd be fun to talk to him about 2011 Correspondents' Dinner. And then, you know, that kind of fell off as he started doing shows.
Was he receptive to the idea?
He said he was receptive to coming in the beginning. There were some caveats he had that we were not interested in doing.
Like what?
Apologizing.
He wanted you to apologize on the air?
Yeah. Which we would never have done. These were conversations that took place with a man named Michael Cohen.
Oh, I've heard of him.
Yeah, he's in the news too. But that was like 2014. I will say—
Did he offer to pay you large sums of money?
We never got that far. but I realize now I should have kept the conversation there. I didn't realize there was cash on the barrel head. So would I say, I'm happy he hasn't been here. Mm-hmm. I think there's this idea that there's a really good interview with him to be had on a late night talk show. I don't think there is.
You know, who has that idea?
I feel like when people criticize his appearances places, I want to say, like, what do you think there is to get out of him?
Well, I mean, when Letterman started doing more political interviews, there was this sense that, like, because he could cut through people.
Right.
By being serious, but then with a joke in an offhand way, which was something Jon Stewart did some of and you do some of. But I think that like there's a sense that like comedy can get in there, right?
Yes.
When somebody is just like bullshitting or not able to be pinned down by a journalist who's going to ask a very traditional set of questions, right?
Yeah, I just think he's so. It's a very good argument. I think he's so untraditional, I still feel as though he would be like trying to tackle a shadow. Mm-hmm. But with that said, so I'm glad he's not here. I would be like stressed out if he was coming. But if he called and said, I want to come on the show, I would have to say yes.
And what would you do? Why would you have to say yes? Because he's the president.
I feel like it would be too unique an opportunity. To go back to what you just said about when it's at its best, mm-hmm. it's wonderful television. Mm-hmm. And then I think the stress would just be when it's, you know, it's one of those things. It's a big opportunity. It was like when I said yes to doing the Correspondents' Dinner, when any of us do. We realize, oh, at its best, this will be something I'll remember for the rest of my life. And if it goes badly, no one will ever let me forget it.
And I feel like you ended up in the former.
I hope so. I think I ended up with like a foot in both.
Again, maybe it's a good thing that the Bin Laden raid happened that night.
So. That's what I try to always remember. You know, look, yeah, he's president, but we got Bin Laden.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.